guest is Phyllis Buttinger. But before we get started, a couple of quick comments. I want to remind everyone that you can also listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on your cell phone by calling area code 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. And also, I want to remind everybody of the Truckers UFO Reporting Center, that's Two Fork, and the web address for that is www.tuforc.com. And for all you truckers out there, if you see something in the sky as you're driving along, be sure and report that to us. We would definitely appreciate that. And about Phyllis, she's an amazing woman. She's had over 35 years of experience in analytical chemistry, and she holds 2 degrees in the field. Well, you have to excuse us here. We're having some computer snafus here and trying to get this all straightened out. Let me get out of David's way so he can do it. Oh, gosh. Let's see. Where was I? Oh, yes. With a lifelong interest in the mystery of the UFO phenomena, that was the impetus for her establishment. Oh, gosh. Oh, let's see. Try this again. I'm sorry, people. I'm a little bit flustered here tonight with computer problems and everything going on. Let me try this again. A lifelong interest in the mystery of the UFO phenomenon was the impetus for her to establish a small laboratory dedicated to the study of physical traces related to UFO events. Frontier Analysis Limited was launched in March 2000, and since then, the laboratory has examined numerous UFO trace samples from all over the world. These include samples from abductions, cattle mutilations, crop circles, UFO deposits, and angel hair. Some highly visible cases for which analysis has been provided include soil traces from the Delphos, Kansas landing event and the dress Betty Hill wore during her abduction. She has been interviewed on national radio talk shows, TV. Recently, she has appeared in episodes for the History Channel's UFO Files and UFO Hunter series. Phyllis has been on my short list of dream guests that I have wanted to have on my program, and so I'm thrilled to finally be able to welcome her as a guest on Eye to the Sky. And welcome, Phyllis, and boy, what a body of work you've participated in.
Well, thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
Just before my computer went haywire on me this evening, I was reading an article about some work that you had done with angel hair, and that's an aspect of UFOs that I found interesting, but very little information on.
Yeah, I have done some work on that. I should have pulled some files on it for you, but I have done work on that, and I think the jury is still out to exactly what it was. In fact, angel hair is what first got me really interested in eventually getting into UFOs, because back in the 70s and that, I was an armchair reader ufologist up to then. I just read, and I was not actively involved. And it bothered me is why I didn't see any good analysis of angel hair. And had with my background, why? Get an infrared spectrum of that. I ought to find out what that is. And that was some of the first things that I looked at. And I've looked at them, and I just haven't had the right samples to look at. Unfortunately, they're all in October, usually mostly in the fall. And ballooning spiders tend to deposit their web at that time. And, in fact, everything I've looked at, I can't differentiate from spider web. And it's always in October but most of the time it's in October. And I've had, most of the cases are from the States. So I really need a bigger database for that. One person who's done a lot of research in this is Brian Boldman, who I worked with, and haven't heard from him lately, we just need more samples, and I think the statistics are coming off the top of my head. There are like something like 30, 40, 50% of angel hair drops, they claim that UFOs have been sighted, and I only have one or two angel hair samples when that happened, and I would definitely like more UFO sightings in conjunction with the angel hair that's dropping, and that's what I'm missing. And still, I have not been able to differentiate angel hair from spider web. I thought I did, but I was on a learning curve about spiders. I'm no entomologist, but I thought that I saw one sample of angel hair that was definitely not spider web because it didn't have the sticky stuff on it. But then I found out that some ballooning spiders don't have that sticky substance on it. So, you know, so anyway, it's been a learning curve, and the jury is still out, and we just need more samples for a bigger database to try to pin this down.
One of the articles that I'd found had said that they had found, oh gosh, a long list of different things that were found in angel hair, such as potassium, silicon, calcium,
yeah.
Phosphorus.
That's an example of an analysis I don't agree with. First of all, it was done by elemental analysis, and spider web and so forth, as it falls, you know, or is in the environment, it collects dirt and stuff. And then we did elemental analysis, and a lot of those things that you see are mineral components of dirt. And so they didn't look what the molecular structure was. The stuff is organic. And they didn't. And so what they're saying, I think, and I've said that in an article that I published, that, that was probably dirt. And what you're seeing is something biological. Well, it looks biological, and, it, and so far, all I've seen is spider silk. I can't differentiate it, maybe. But then again, maybe some aliens or something like that out there, way out there in the universe, have a use for it. Because it is known as biosteel, it's probably the strongest for its denier and so forth than any polymer or anything that we could make on Earth when you stop to think of it. So who knows? So a lot of work needs to be done on that after all these years. So
One element that they were talking about in this article I was reading on the subject said that even in a small number of samples that they had even found, now I hope I'm going to pronounce this correctly, tritium, which is used as a neutron absorption material in nuclear reactors.
Okay. I am skeptical. I'd like to know how they did the analysis.
Well, unfortunately, partway through reading that article, I didn't get to complete it. My fan of my CPU, my computer, quit.
Who wrote the article?
I didn't even look. I was just quickly scanning it, and like I said, that's when my computer decided to say, forget you.
I would like to see how they got the information and how they did the analysis and so forth, and would have to know more background on it. But right now, the flag goes up with me. I don't really trust the analysis. I don't, from what I found, so who knows.
I hadn't gotten very far into the article, but the way I found it was I had Googled your name and angel hair.
Okay, yeah.
And this was one of the articles that came up with your name in it, and I hadn't gotten to the part with you in it yet.
Okay.
Before my computer died on me. Okay, one thing I think a lot of my listeners are probably interested in the most right now is the analysis that you did on Betty Hill's dress.
Oh, Betty Hill. Yeah, that was one of my favorite in an analysis. And first of all, probably a background on the case. Maybe some people don't know it. A brief might
certainly
be in order. Well, this happened on September 19th of 1961. And Betty and Barney, along with their dog, Dulcy, were coming home to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, from an extended weekend pleasure trip to Canada. And the itinerary took them to Niagara Falls and Montreal and then home. Well, they were traveling south on U.S. Route 3 in central New Hampshire, and mid-evening, roughly around 10:15, they noticed a bright star, and it appeared to move erratically. And they continued to observe it as it apparently paced them, and it got closer and closer. And Barney stopped the car, and he retrieved a .22 pistol from the trunk. And, well, he resumed the drive, and both Betty and Barney looked at the object through binoculars, and they observed a spinning, flat, and circular disc with multicolored lights on the rim. Well, about 2 miles north of Woodstock, the object descended and hovered about 100 feet in the air. And no spinning, they didn't notice any spinning. And a blue-white fluorescent glow shined through the windows. The object was about the size of a four-engine aircraft. At this point, Barney stopped the car and got out, and he could see several uniformed human-like figures. And he was afraid they were about to be abducted, so he jumped in the car and he raced down the road. And then he heard a irregular beeping sound, and the hills felt a tingling sensation and became drowsy. And the next thing they remembered was a series of beeps as they were passing through Plymouth, and it took several more miles before they became fully awake and the crash was gone, and there was 2 hours of missing time. Both felt clammy and dirty, and Barney's lower abdomen was bothering him. Their wristwatches had quit working, and there were unexplained marks on the car. Well, both Betty and Barney sought therapy, and eventually hypnosis was done by Dr. Benjamin Simon, who had no knowledge or even interest in UFOs. Yet the hypnosis suggested that both Betty and Barney had been abducted and subjected to physical examination. So, how I got the samples was the fact that, and I analyzed them many years later, but the September 2001 issue of the MUFON Journal had two fascinating articles on the Hills abduction, and these were in commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the event. And one was by Dwight Connolly, and the other was Kathy Martin, who is Betty's niece. And Connolly's article had a recent picture of Betty holding the dress she wore, and along with it was descriptions of powdery material, and the dress was had suffered. But until I saw that, I was amazed. I didn't know the dress existed, and from the descriptions, it seemed possible that maybe it had physical evidence of the abduction. And I had never seen any reports of any analysis on it, so I immediately contacted both Dwight and Kathy Martin concerning the possibility of getting some samples of the dress. And Kathy contacted Betty with some persuasion, and which I'm indebted to, got Betty to agree to giving me some swabs. And by November, I had received a couple pieces of the dress, one from a discolored area and then one from the area that was the original color. This was to be used as a control. And then later on, I received some more swatches, and this was in July of 2002 when I had the pleasure of meeting Betty Hill face-to-face and Kathy Martin at a Rochester, a New York MUFON meeting. And Betty brought the dress and let me cut out some more swatches for analysis. So that's how I got the samples, and the analysis was on.
Oh, I'm jealous now. You got to meet Betty.
Oh, it was wonderful. She was a wonderful person and quite a character. I even taped some conversation with her, which I would cherish and so forth. But, she was quite a lady and a fun person. And you liked her immediately. So she came to our she was in our room for about an hour and a half, and both her and Kathy Martin, and we had quite a conversation. And she was more interested at the time about talking about her genealogical research and her family origins, I remember. But yeah, she was a doll.
And what was the findings that you were able to come up with?
Well, let me tell you a little about the history, because if you're an analytical chemist, you should know what the dress had been through in the last 40 years, because that is half the analysis, and can lead you on due to the proper test. And there's a lot of reasons. And so I dug the history of the dress out of her, and I haven't seen anything in the literature about the history of it. But so Betty was able to fill me in, and the dress that she wore that night was brand new, and she had only worn it one other day during that weekend. It had never been laundered, and it was unusually warm for September, but it was not very humid. And when the abduction began, Betty said that the two beings were on each side of her and escorted her to the craft with their hands under her armpits. And she said that she put up, and I quote, a hell of a fight before she crossed the threshold of the craft. And she didn't want to go inside that craft. Yeah, no way, no way at all. And so I asked, did you hit them with your hands? And she says, oh, no, I kicked like hell because my arms were restricted. So obviously the dress suffered stresses. And then on the craft, she remembers that halfway through the physical examination, they decided to remove the dress. And they had a lot of difficulties with the zipper. And once they removed the dress, they threw it on the floor of the craft in a heap. They weren't... they didn't hang it up. It was just thrown on the floor in a big pile. But at any event, when Betty and Barney arrived home, she undressed to go to bed. And I have a little quote. She sent me a letter. She said to me, when I returned home that morning, I put my dress folded in the bottom of my closet, where it remained several days, and when I removed it, it was covered with a pink powder. So I threw it in the trash, but I quickly changed my mind. I decided to put it outdoors in the sun, and the powder blew away, but leaving stains. Betty said she didn't notice any odor coming from the dress. She noticed the damage on the dress. The lining on the right side of the dress was torn from the waist to the hem, and the top of the zipper was ripped. And of course, because the damaged dress could never be worn again. So what happened to the dress between for 40 years after that? Well, she hung it on a hanger in the closet. It had not been enclosed in a protective bag. And I found out that no disinfectants, moth repellent, or any other chemicals were ever sprayed in the closet. And occasionally she would bring the dress out and show visitors. And one wonders what happened to Barney's clothes. Well, I found out that he immediately had a suit cleaned right after the event that day, and the day after the event. So it never developed a pink powder or was it discolored in any way. There was no damage at all to his clothing. So that was the history, and it figures on some of my interpretation is why I mentioned that. So,
That would show that you know, A, she didn't wash it, so it couldn't, you know, the stains couldn't be a result of maybe accidental bleach being poured in, or any chemical reactions with stuff.
And it was a good thing that it was a new dress, because you could rule out a lot of stuff immediately, you know.
True.
Anyhow, I noticed extensive discoloration along the top half of the dress, and especially in the underarms, and to a much lesser extent on the bottom of the dress. And these areas, where the pinkness is that's where Betty says the pink color resided, the pink powder resided, I should say. And the waist area, all that, is the original blue color. So, anyway, I had several swatches, obviously, and what I found, I can summarize what I found. The discolored pink magenta areas of the outer dress had suffered chemical attack on both the dye and the fiber. And I noticed that the fiber was coated with a biologically derived material, which is composed mostly of protein, in short, mold, and a small amount of natural ester-type oil. And some of this had deteriorated, even that, the mold had deteriorated over the years, but it was a little, it wasn't extensive. And I found more of these substances are on the exterior surface of the dress than on the interior. And this shows that definitely that the substance comes from an external source. It was not Betty, definitely not. I also had some DNA analysis done, hopefully seeing if there would be any, I knew it was a long shot after all this time, could there be alien DNA or something unidentifiable, which would indicate something unusual. But we found a bacteria and assorted human DNA, which could be from the many people handling the dress over the years. And I think we saw some of Barney's DNA. But I just want to emphasize that the analytical results clearly rule out any natural substances coming from Betty. I have some speculations on this. Betty told me there was a most unpleasant, unidentifiable odor on the craft, and she said it was like marigold light, and which does not smell very good. And I speculated that this odor could have emanated from the craft occupants and could be a result of natural body elimination of oils or respiratory agents. And I think these transferred to the dress on contact. The pink areas are most profound around the top of the dress, and like I said, well, especially around the sleeves where the captors had gripped Betty as they escorted her to and from the craft. So, again, I emphasize that wherever Betty claimed contact, there is the pink stain, and there is a high concentration of the mold. So, I think also that some of these damp biological components from these people found on the dress were probably also on Betty's skin, causing her to feel clammy and dirty. And I don't think that the original deposited substance on the dress directly caused the discoloration. Betty found the discoloration days later when she took off the dress. And the substance on the dress was probably moist, so the moisture was not allowed to dissipate because the dress was folded initially. And this moist substance probably served as a nutrient for natural biological growth, like mold or so forth. So I saw the secondary product, the mold. And I think this grew, and when the dress finally dried, a pink powdery residue from the growth probably remained. It was this mold material that probably caused the discoloration and interacted with the dress fiber. The interior and the drier lining suffered minimal effects, very little effects. It appears that small remnants of the original traces of the material remain for For example, the bacteria identified by DNA with soil bacteria, and I find it likely that a soil-type bacteria, which was found on the left sleeve, got there when the dress was thrown on the craft floor, because the event occurred in a rural area in a dirt road, and clearly dirt could have been trapped in by the footwear worn by Betty and the craft occupants. So I think that supports her story. But those were my speculations, some of them. And in short, like I said, it was Betty Post and the Betty Hildreth were the big ones.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndre, and tonight my guest is Phyllis Buttinger. Phyllis, you were telling me about an interesting case, and for the life of me, I can't remember where it happened, or when, but it entailed a pair of disintegrating boots.
Oh, yeah, that is an interesting one. What happened? Well, this came to me via William Puckett of UFOs Northwest out of Washington, though the event actually happened between Missouri and Ohio. But the background is there was two witnesses, a husband and a wife, and they experienced two encounters with a UFO over a two-day period. That's early August, early August 24th and early August 25th, 2005. The couple were traveling from Eagle Rock, Missouri, to a small camping park in Marion, Ohio, and the first encounter was near Indianapolis, Indiana, while traveling east on I-70, and the woman, who is the primary witness, saw bright flames to the north, and she became quite sickened by a strong odor, which is similar to creosote, sulfuric acid, and tar. She used to work for Dow Chemical and is quite familiar with chemical odors. After continuing to drive east on I-70, the couple stopped for fuel near the Indiana-Ohio border. I'm very familiar with that area. It's Richmond, Indiana. And the woman saw several lights in the sky and became sick again, and the same foul odor. Then the next night, while driving on U.S. Highway 61 near Mount Gilead, Ohio, she saw a large triangular object. And again, she smelled the same strong odor, and she then also felt a mist-like substance on her skin. Well, she had just purchased a new pair of black boots, and they were marketed by Walmart, but she purchased them from a second party. And she said she had never worn the boots before the trip. Well, the synthetic suede on the surface of the boots was stripped clean in several areas after her two encounters. And the witness, she suffered severe physical effects from the encounters, and this lasted for more than a month. And the doctor's diagnosis was chemical pneumonia and kidney infection. And her husband, the effects on him were even more severe. Well, this case, by the way, is in the MUFON Journal of August 2006. If anybody wants to see it, all you have to do is tap into the MUFON, www.mufon.com, and tap into the journals. And William Puckett wrote up the story. But anyway, he sent me the left boot, and sure enough, looking at the boot, you see all kinds of suede stripped partially from the boot in various sections. Well, I looked at the boot, and the boot's covered with 6 suede, which is a polyurethane. And the outer surface also has silicone, which is commonly used as a water repellent. And I saw all kinds of normal shoe debris like dirt and talc from foot powder and all kinds of things. I went all over the boot inside and out. Well, from this, I really didn't see anything on the boot, but from what the witness said, and I could make really good speculations on this and identifying as to what was probably present, though I didn't actually detect it, because it's really unusual that the suede came off the new boot. And the witness, you know, backup and the background on the story is very important. And that's why I said earlier on in the broadcast that it's important to get the background so you can see how to go about this and so forth. But she described a creosote sulfuric acid and tar odor during the event, and this is a very important clue. Creosote contains phenolic-type materials, among other things. So this could possibly indicate the presence of phenolic, so not necessarily from creosote. And if the boot was exposed to these materials, there's a real possibility that they caused the adhesive to fail. I got my really thick polymer handbook by Immergood out, and I looked up polyurethanes, and the glue too is composed of polyurethane and suede, obviously, as I just said. But in it, they only mentioned 4 things that polyurethane is soluble in. One is phenol, metacresol, which is a phenolic type compound, formic acid, and sulfuric acid. Well, phenols sublime easy and would have been gone by the time I received the boot for analysis, and therefore I might not have detected it. And I can easily rule out sulfuric acid and formic acid because pH measurements on the boot surface were neutral and even skewed to the basic side. Well, these phenolic materials are hazardous and are known to cause the effects that were suffered by the witness. So by process of elimination, I think I might have come up with what might have caused the suede to come off the boot. And why this happened, I have no idea. It's weird. You know, whenever you get an unknown, something you can't explain, there's sometimes something weird going on. That shouldn't have been there. So it's, again, what really happened? Why was it there? I have no idea. But I think that's what caused it.
Oh, that's interesting. How do I start this one? You did some work on a case that in Brazil that,
mm-hmm.
Well, you and I have discussed this case.
Mm-hmm.
And we're both of the same opinion that it's a total hoax,
mm-hmm.
by a known hoaxer.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like to know, or let you know, or have you tell our listeners a little bit of the work you've done on investigating that.
A full expose of this case, again, found in the MUFON Journal. You can access it on the website. And it was the August 2003 issue. And a feature article was written by Dwight Connolly and takes up the lion's share of the journal that month. But let me start to describe this character. He's colorful and rather shady. Before I get into the specific event from which I got the samples. And I'll give you his background. And this was known, by the way, in Brazil, but not by anybody here, as I understand. And A.J. Devard, I think that's how you pronounce his name. My Portuguese isn't that good. He is the MUFON director of Brazil. And other ufologists had been investigating this guy's claims for several years, and they found they were all hoaxes. And Oliveira had an operation called Project Portal, People were told that they would be safe on the property, protected by extraterrestrials when a pretended natural disaster came. Promoted it as a place where people would have parapsychological experiences and so forth. He faked psychic powers, and he simulated UFOs with a couple of 12-volt batteries and car headlights about 200 meters to fool the people that he, to fool people he wanted to fool. He used laser pointers, advertisement balloons, and so forth. He also claimed he could cure diseases like AIDS, cancer, and leukemia, and of course for a charge. And he was also arrested for fraud at one point. So Project Portal was nothing more than a huge setup aiming at profit. And there were numerous other complaints and so forth regarding Project Portal. And the Brazilian people saw reports on TV and printed media about the farce. So with no one in Brazil believing him, he probably had a cash flow problem and decided to target our country with his farce. So what he did is he duped an investigator from the States to investigate and report an alleged abduction he experienced on September 15, 2002 to promote his operation. And this was complete with bogus physical evidence. And let me give you a brief account that Oliveira gave of his experience. He said several days before the event, he had received telepathic information he would be transported aboard an alien craft on September 15, 2002, by 10 p.m. And this would be heralded by a rain of rocks lasting 7 minutes. Well, just after 7 p.m. on this date, indeed a stone drop did occur. And Urander Olivar was laying in his bed in his undershorts, and anticipating the event, he said he was suddenly enveloped in a violet flash. His body, he said, sensed an increase in temperature, which he described as fever. He said he became paralyzed, and he said in essence he was beamed up through the ceiling of the waiting craft. And I guess he was there a couple days, as he said. And as a result of the beam-up, his body image was imprinted into the bedding. It was burned into it. And, in fact, the image, body image on the sheet visually appears to consist of burned areas and halo-like areas. And, furthermore, a charred-appearing image shows up on the ceiling wood. Well, samples of bedding fragments and the falling stones with this event were sent to me for analysis. And as expected, the bedding was found to be exposed to heat, and I didn't see any unusual residues. All I saw was the usual residual detergent and sizing material and so forth. But of prime interest was a sample of bedding of the sheet from the burn area and from the halo area, some samples from both areas, because it appeared to have regular, evenly spaced melted beams of beads of material on it. There were lots of oohing and aahing on the appearance and speculation that this was nothing earthly could cause this. This was some alien type thing, event, and so forth. Well, I looked at the sheet, and I found it was composed of a cotton cross-woven with polyester. It wasn't a blend. It was cross-woven, cotton going one direction and polyester going the other. So it was very obvious to me that on heat exposure, the polyester melted and the cotton, and that's a natural product. Cotton doesn't melt. It either remained tacked or intact or charred on during the heat exposure, and depending where it was located in the burn area. So therefore, there was a regular appearance of melted beads on the sheet. And furthermore, I could reproduce the effect with a hot iron on a control piece of the sheet in the lab. And I didn't have a heat gun at the time. I wish I would have had that. I could have gone even higher temperatures. But anyway, if I recall correctly, I think that one of the Brazilian ufologists told me that a, a henchman of Olivera's fessed up to using a blowtorch on the sheet in the ceiling. But so that would explain what happened to the sheet. And what about the stones? Well, they have the stones had an outer hard surface, and inside they were filled with sand. It's not common, but it's not out of the world either. And with this analysis, Nick Ryder, who is a good friend of mine, and we work together on analyses. He does elemental analysis. I do spectroscopy, and we work back and forth on our various projects. Well, he nailed this one down. Besides being an elemental analysis expert, he knows a lot about rocks and minerals and so forth. And anyhow, he showed that these were minerals which have a sedimentary origin, and he said the stones are very similar to Moki marbles. And Moki marbles also consist of an outer shell with center of sandstone. And these are found in the Utah and Arizona areas, and I've also been told that there are also clusters of similar types of stones in Brazil. And I might add that Moki marbles are readily available and sold worldwide. They're a favorite of rock collectors and also people who endorse the New Age philosophies. The New Agers think they have healing properties, and they use them to contact animal spirits and so forth. And some of them even claim they can be used for contacting ETs for visioning and for journeying. But in summation, there was nothing unusual or out of the world about any of those samples. And, you know, there were a lot of questions up front on this, such as why wasn't Olivera's underwear affected? It would seem to me to be very useful to analyze his underwear, especially since his undershirts were purported to be aboard an alien craft for 2 days. Another question is, while the ceiling was scorched, what about the roof? It would seem that all the components in the path of the beam-up should have experienced the same heat effect. So, at any rate, there were a lot of discrepancies that should have been caught early, but I guess some investigators, I want the belief syndrome caused them to overlook the discrepancies and really prevented an objective look at the scientific data. But that's basically the story of it, and I put a lot of time on that, and it does get you upset, but I felt good because that was exposed, and nobody was going to be duped from the United States. So.
You know, and quite a few of my listeners might also remember this case as well. There was photographs of the sheets and mm-hmm. of the ceiling on yeah. Art Bell's website for quite
yeah.
some time.
Yeah, that was interesting, a photograph. If I remember correctly, there were photographs taken right when this event was supposed to happen, and the room was supposed to be sealed. And when the investigator got there, I guess more photographs were taken, and they could clearly see that they were different. I don't know if the sheet was different or not. I can't remember correctly, but I think someone up in one of the groups up in Washington State, something like that, I can't remember the details, they spotted the discrepancies right there, that they were not looking at the same thing. The room was not sealed, in other words. They could see the differences. So, and it had a lot to do with the way the bedding was placed and so forth. And even behind the bed, it was different.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, and I don't have it quite right. I have to look in my files on that, but there was somebody had pointed that out. It was quite a case.
What is your favorite case that you've worked on?
Oh, gosh. That's easy. There's two, Delphos and Biddy Hill. Those are the favorite because I knew those, everything supported the authenticity of them, the analytical data. Betty Hill's, it's speculative, but it's her version of the story. Like I said, it would support her story. I didn't find anything against it, and I really truly believe it happened as the way she said it. And of course, Delphos, there's no question in my mind that that happened also. And when you work on something, you know it's authentic. It's those are your favorites. I remember on the Betty Hill case, I had the samples for about 3-4 months, and I believed the story, but all of a sudden it hit me from some of the stuff I was finding. I had one of these, this oh my God syndrome for 3 weeks, and I was spaced out. I said, this really is true. You know, you sort of believe it, and then you didn't. I said, this really is true, because I was finding things that would support her story, not proof that the dress was, you know, with any unusual residues of the dress was, but it was all the circumstantial evidence around it that she said this happened. Well, here's some dirt, bacteria dirt on her, you know, left sleeve that must have been thrown on the floor or whatever. And there's other things too. She said she sat at a picnic bench on the way down to eat a hot dog, and I didn't go into that, but I found a spider blood on the lining of her dress, and I thought that was amusing because she apparently sat on a couple of spiders. DNA discovered that, but anyway, in summation, Betty Hill and Delphos are my favorites.
Well, you're finding the traces of spider on the dress.
Mm-hmm.
Tells me you went over that with a fine tooth.
Oh, yeah. It took me a good 6 months. I took many, many spectra, and I took off particulates. I did extractions of the material, and I spent a lot of time on that. I found a lot of the typical house debris. I remember pulling off a cat hair, and Betty had a cat, and taking a spectrum of it, and I went right down to every little particle I could find, and every square centimeter of the swaths I had, front side and back side, I took spectra of. I literally have about 20 spectra taken of stuff from that sample. I mean, from those samples. So, but it was interesting.
I think it is too. I mean, gosh, you've done a tremendous amount of work on that. What are some of the other cases that you've worked on that you'd like to talk about?
Oh, let's see. Here's the Michigan car residue. That was an interesting one.
Yes, this is the one that was on, was it UFO Files?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the one, yeah, and with Ted Phillips, myself, and that we discussed Delphos, too. But that is an interesting one, because it sort of gave a little information about the object. Again, you know, a lot of it's speculation. I had a small amount of sample, but, you know, a little bit here and a little bit there, maybe be able to put a pattern together when enough of these samples are analyzed. Let me give you the background on this.
Certainly.
This is an event that happened in Michigan on November 27th, 1998. Shirley, a woman, was driving east on 25-mile road north of Mount Clemens, Michigan. Well, it was getting dark, and all of a sudden she noted a really highly intense white basketball-sized object rapidly coming toward her. And it had no sound, and it hit the car with a slight thump. Well, where the impact occurred, there was a cream-colored residue. And the car was a 92 Ford Escort station wagon. And there was no evidence of impact on the car even after the hit. So the idea was to identify what is the residue, what can it tell us about the object. Well, I found that the residue left by the object on the car contains metal oxide and a silicate mineral, specifically a common kaolinite type, and a cellulosal material, that is plant material, indicates plant origin, and it had a trace of natural ester. Well, looking at this these materials that actually some of the information could be related about the object itself, looking at these the spectra. For example, I looked at the paint, too, of the car, and I didn't see any degradation of the paint, nor of the cellular stuff and the plant. And the fact that the inorganics in the gray material are hydrated, they have water molecules on them, that would indicate that there was no heat transference to the car. So, and it indicated that the object itself was not hot. And if the object were hot, these materials on it, like the silicate and metal oxide, would not be hydrated, and the celluloidal material would have been incinerated. We know the object, well, it appears the object was not hot, and Shirley reported a dull thud on impact. And that, along with the fact that the car was not dented, suggests the object had a very low mass. So, anyhow, this would tend to rule out a bolide or meteorite, because that, I think, would be expected to leave a sizable dent. So, it was rather interesting. So, we could speculate on that one so forth. The object obviously wasn't under control either, because it hit the car. But I think it's possible, this is grasping at straws, that the silicate mineral and the celluloidal material on the object could have suggested where it came from. And I speculate it may be a pond or a field. And it's grasping at straws, but I do have precedence for suggesting the pond theory. Ted Phillips told me, he's very highly interested in basketball-sized UFOs, and he says the sightings have increased substantially in recent years, and he said many are observed near ponds and caves. And I myself know of a case that happened in July 2000 where a number of these basketball-sized objects paced a car for many miles. And if you look on a map on a highway where the event occurred, you'll see numerous ponds and lakes. So we had a lot of speculations, and maybe this told us a little about the object. So it's interesting from that aspect of a little bit of residue might imply.
That one was an interesting case. I remember watching that, and wasn't that was the Trace case episode, if I remember correctly, with Ted Phillips.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, we were both on it.
I think that was my first introduction to you.
Okay, that was a while ago. That was a while ago. That was filmed about 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, I don't know, something like that. But I see it's replayed constantly, so over ad nauseum.
Oh, I don't think so. As long as the word gets out that this phenomenon is real, that there is physical evidence for it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the work you do on this is, I think, absolutely wonderful, and I applaud you for it. You've done an excellent job.
Thank you.
Is there any others that you find fascinating?
I could tell you about the Centerville. I didn't find anything that exciting about it, but the case is, just I can briefly touch on it. You asked me about that when I talked to you on the phone.
Oh, yeah.
I could just briefly tell you about it, because the sighting itself is unusual. This event happened in Centerville, Ohio, at about 5:30 in the morning on a Saturday morning on March 6, 2002. And the residents there, apparently, they saw a UFO interacting with power lines. And the interaction was actually explosive in nature, and it involved the burning of treetops. And flame and glitter from the trees were purported to continue for several hours after the event. I happened to tap into the to some eyewitness reports from the Black Vault Encyclopedia Project that John Greenwald has, and I found the residents' comments interesting. I said that this house-size object was saucer-shaped, was a saucer-shaped metallic structure, polished aluminum surface with alternating sets of rotating flare-like lights. Two sets of lights clearly rotated in opposite directions, and they were very bright, consisting of several colors ranging from yellow, amber, white, and blue, and there was no smoke or exhaust that could be seen. Well, this UFO was somehow interacting with the power lines. It was near an elementary school, according to some, one of the witnesses. And this is really weird. After each blinding explosion, the air pressure in the neighborhood would change with a loud concussion, and at that point, all the power would go out across the neighborhood. And following the disruption, the UFO would vanish from its place at treetop level near the school. The same or separate identical object would then reappear over an adjacent field as the power in the region would slowly restore. And this object would then assume a slow path and amble back toward the school to its previous position where it would again explode with a flash after making some kind of arcing contact with the power lines. And the resident said that this would repeat several times. It was like deja vu Groundhog Day, and it kept repeating. And it was really weird. And I sort of wonder if there's some kind of dimensional quality to this. But anyway, I got tree branches, several branches from this, and it's not that exciting because, yeah, it was burned. It was a burned physical trace material. I just saw, I didn't see any foreign objects, and I saw typical burning byproducts like carbon, calcium, and organic oxidation products, typical. But I checked everything that comes in here for radioactivity and fluorescent materials, and this was absent, so that was reassuring. But this is a physical trace which could be related to a possible UFO presence. And I might add, in conclusion, that there is no transformer in the area which might have blown, so we can rule that out. But just from the effect and disappearing and the deja vu thing is really weird. So I had to report that one and tell you about it. So.
That's interesting because, you know, a lot of reports from the 50s on tell of strange objects around power lines and power plants and power substations.
This one seemed to be in trouble, though. You know, it sounded like it had a problem from what it sounds like.
Yeah, it does. Come in and give it. You know, it kind of makes me think of the Exeter, New Hampshire incident of 1965, and the gentleman that wrote about that, Raymond Fowler, went through the area and was asking people, have you seen anything along this line? And a lot of people kept telling him, yes, we see them following the high-tension power lines all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had a case that just literally made you, you know, stumped you or just, you know, that what you found just you couldn't figure out how to explain?
Well, a lot of this I can't figure out. If you notice, I keep using the word speculation, and it's when you can't explain, because I literally try to find everything out that could be a possible explanation. I've even called research labs that make a product, for instance, and could this cause this, could that cause that, you know. And I have found things that shouldn't be where they are. And I have no explanation. And I think in some of these cases, you notice I did have speculations, and I don't know. There is one real interesting cattle mutilation, animal mutilation that I had just recently that has me going. Pardon?
Care to expand on it?
Yeah. This is actually a bull bison. His name was Frank, I think. He lived in Saskatchewan. And most of your listeners probably know that the typical modus operandi of an animal mutilation. Surgical excitation of the genitals and the blood drained and the eye removed and this and that. Well, poor old Frank, he had this done to him. And he was last seen alive on March 10th, 2008, and he was found mutilated on March 13th, 2008 in a circle of melted snow. He had been in excellent health, and he had all his inoculations, and there were 14 other bulls in the field with him, and nearby were 200 bison calves and cows. And I was sent various samples from the bull. And on the hair sample, the other samples, I didn't find anything unusual, but on the hair sample, I found a compound called 3-hydroxyanthranilic acid. I have no idea where that could come from. We couldn't relate it to a substance introduced by the farmer or from the environment. And a literature search, I really went over the net, and also the investigator did too, and trying to find out. It did pop up, any common uses for it or anything. Well, actually, I kept seeing that it's a metabolic product of tryptophan, but if so, it shouldn't have been found on the cow's hair outside. It's been used in various research or associated with some cancer research, too, I think. But I have no idea. It stumps me where it comes from. It's a total, blank. I don't know. And so what do you do? You just put it out there, and it'll be put out in the website one of these days, and maybe somebody out viewing out this could give an explanation. That's another good reason for putting these reports on the website. Probably somebody will look at it and say, oh, your speculation is wrong. This is what this is due to, really. And it might be a normal explanation or something, rational explanation. But anyhow, that one has me stumped.
Wow. Interesting. You were also on an episode of UFO Hunters.
Mm-hmm.
That one was interesting.
Yeah, that was on Betty Hill Griff. Yeah.
And I love that. Just out of curiosity, what is your opinion of the programs UFO Hunters and UFO Files? Do you think they're doing a valid service to the subject?
They're trying to get the information out there, though UFO Hunters does put a titch of a spin on it. But they got to make it entertaining too. But obviously they're still making episodes, and so that means the viewership. They have the viewership, and that's a good thing. So the cases basically are reported, but I do see a little bit of spin and a little. Put on them. So but they think basically the event did happen. So
I've been noticing that as well.
Yeah. But it's getting information out about UFOs, and they're trying to make that they're getting some professional people looking at them. And there are a lot of people looking at it professionally, but you got to watch the spin. If you want to know the really basic stuff, you know, do a web search or something and get the true story.
I agree. We have a question from a member of our virtual auditorium. He goes by the nickname of, he or she, rather, goes by the nickname of Zandroid. And Zandroid asks, do animals react to any of the trace evidence?
I can tell you, I have the evidence I have. Let's see. I really don't know the answer to that. I do know that the animals have reacted to UFOs. In fact, I just ordered that book finally about animal reactions to UFOs, and I haven't read it yet. But Snowball, which was the dog that Ron Johnson had in the Delphos case, he was basically an outside dog, and after the event, he refused to go outside. And not only that, he developed some kind of an eye problem soon after that event that had to be attended to, and I don't know if he lost that eye eventually or what. And whether it was due to the physical evidence, I don't know, or the blinding light, I don't know. Delsey was the adoptant that was with Betty Hill and Barney when they were adopted. Now, Delsey was very frightened by the whole event, and shivering in the back of the car, I believe, if I recall. And about, I think, a few months, she developed a skin problem after that. So,
yeah, I had often wondered what happened with Delsey. You know, what happened with her while they were away from the car.
Well, it was a very frightened puppy dog, I guess, when they got back. And from what I understand, and again, it developed some kind of a skin problem after that. So that's basically all I know about it.
Okay, we have about 3 minutes. Is there anything that you would like to like a websites or books you would recommend to our listeners, or anything you just want to say to anybody?
Well, I could recommend some websites. Nancy Talbot's website, www.bltresearch.com, has reports some really good work done with on samples from various events. Ted Phillips' website is ufophysical.com. However, I checked into it the other day and I saw it was under construction, but I understand that. That's one of his new websites. And, of course, everybody probably, most people recommend www.mufon.com, the MUFON website. And it's really it's very informative, and it's really nice that they have all their journals archived there, and you can read anything you want and go back as far as you want. I think mostly pretty far. But. And, of course, I'm going to recommend www.theblackvault.com by John Greenwald's website, because he is going to assemble really a great website, UFO encyclopedia. And I repeat that I will try to get my reports eventually on there. We have already talked to him about it this week, and it's going to take a while, but I'll have everything on there to be available for everyone.
I got that email as well, and I applaud John for the work he's doing.
He's a really nice guy, and he's one of us. He's a great guy.
I also look forward to seeing your reports and stuff on there. It'd be, I think, an interesting read.
Could be a resource for other researchers. So I've been thinking a long time about how am I going to expose this, and all this information, and put it out to the public, to everyone? And when that letter went around for him, which I guess it was last week, well, I immediately responded. So, So, yeah, it's a very great idea. It's going to be so valuable, that whole UFO encyclopedia project that he's got. It's valuable already because I was referencing before for some of the background and some of the cases I brought today because I didn't have it all together. I thought, well, John's got it. So, but
well, unfortunately, we're out of time, and my, how time flies.
It sure does. Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed this evening, and thank you again, Phyllis, for being on. It was wonderful.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. And in the name of my listeners, I thank you in their name as well. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and also thank those who joined us in the Pal Talk Auditorium. You've all come up with some pretty interesting questions this evening. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight is author Paul Van Ward. And please join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, when my guest will be contactee Jim Maroney. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. And good night, everyone. And we're cleared. Just as he's going to try and keep the sound down because he's having problems with the